Maybe people got scared off a little bit by all the information this morning, but hope not. We're continuing our lesson entitled The Emperor Has No Clothes. And of course, as we talked about this morning, we're talking about the theory of evolution, the fact that even some of the most well-known evolutionists recognize that the theory has a lot of holes and problems, and unfortunately, that doesn't get out to the general public. As you consider the theory of evolution, it drives me crazy when people say, well, it's not a theory, it's fact. Well, it's not fact at all, and I think that we've already seen that there are a lot of problems with it. This morning, we ended talking about spontaneous generation, which is taking non-life and going to something that is alive, and that the theory of evolution absolutely positively requires that to be true. Yet at the very same time, even the most diehard evolutionists recognize that the odds of that happening are totally insurmountable. It cannot possibly be true, yet people cling to the theory. So spontaneous generation is a non-starter. It's an impossibility that even the evolutionists recognize. So it's a fatal blow to the theory in and of itself. So indeed, the emperor has no clothes. Next, we want to consider, helps when you turn it on, we want to consider another important aspect of the theory of evolution that is absolutely positively required to be true in order for the theory to hold together. And that's the idea of random mutations and natural selection or survival of the fittest. Again, mutations are small changes in an organism's DNA. And remember, DNA provides the blueprint for every organism, for its structure, its function, its very survival. So according to the theory of evolution, over millions and millions of years, there's been millions and millions of beneficial mutations that have taken place to DNA, and these mutations are supposed to increase the organism's ability to survive and reproduce. Well, first of all, when you think about that, there's a numbers problem involved. Again, go back to this simple diagram of a bacterium over millions of years evolving into an elephant. Think of the many billions of mutations, all positive, that would have to take place in order for that change to occur. It boggles the mind to even think about. And each mutation that took place would have to increase the organism's ability to survive. Well, what about that? Can random mutations and natural selection possibly get this job done? Well, one line of evidence looks at population genetics. Population genetics tells us that animals with a 20-year generation interval, which would be about what an elephant is, the human generation interval is about 30 years, could pass along no more than 1,700 total mutations in 10 million years. Paleontologists estimate, for example, that man first appeared on Earth somewhere 100,000 to 200,000 years ago. So that's far too short of a time span to consider. So even if we talked about a human instead of an elephant, and we put that generation interval at a shorter 20 years, over the span of 200,000 years, there would only be 34 total mutations that would have time to take place. And as we're going to learn, more often than not, in fact, almost exclusively when a mutation takes place, it's not beneficial. It's very harmful to the animal. The second problem is that we have an information problem. Make sure I'm on the right slide here. Again, one can only imagine the tremendous increase in information it would take for a bacteria versus you and I. Our genome, the DNA that's in our cells, contains just oodles and oodles more information than is in this one-celled organism. But research on genetic mutations, again, overwhelmingly shows that when a mutation takes place, there is less information rather than more. Mutations do not build up information, they do the opposite. Go back to what we talked about this morning with the molecule of hemoglobin. Just a mutation that changes one amino acid out of 570 produces the condition of sickle cell anemia. It's a loss of information, and it certainly isn't helpful to those folks that are stricken by that disorder. But research, again, this fellow, Dr. Lee Spitner, is a biophysicist, an evolutionist, by the way. That's kind of the theme here, that I'm using their own material against them. But he says that the neo-Darwinian theory, the theory of evolution, is supposed to explain how the information of life has built up by evolution. The essential biological difference between a human and a bacterium is in the information they contain. All other biological differences follow from that. The human genome has much more information than does the bacterial genome. Now notice, information cannot be built up by mutations that lose it. A business can't make money by losing it a little at a time. And we all know that from common sense. In fact, when you read the sixth edition of Darwin's Origin of Species, he abandoned natural selection. He said natural selection is incompetent to account for the incipient stages of useful structures, or in essence, evolution. So he came to recognize that, you know, that probably wasn't such a great idea after all. Well, not only is there a numbers problem and an information problem with random mutations and natural selection, there's the survival problem, which I've already alluded to. Again, almost all mutations of DNA are shown to be harmful to organisms rather than helpful. In fact, I did a little research on human mutations, and when you think of mutations in human DNA, think of things like Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis is a genetic mutation, Huntington's disease. In fact, according to Johns Hopkins University, it's kind of a well-trusted institution, there are 21,565 known genetic disorders in humans that affect 3 to 4% of babies that are born, and many of those mutations are fatal. That is one reason, or a primary reason for stillborn babies, is because they have some sort of genetic disorder that just doesn't make it possible for them to survive. Well, let's look at another quotation here. This time by this Frenchman, who was actually the past president of the French Academy of Science, an evolutionist. He said, the mass of evidence shows that all, or almost all, known mutations are unmistakably pathological, and the few remaining ones are highly suspect. So again, the emperor has no clothes. He goes on to say, no matter how numerous they may be, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. The opportune appearance of mutations permitting animals and plants to meet their needs seems hard to believe. Yet Darwinian theory is even more demanding. A single plant or a single animal would require thousands and thousands, I would say maybe billions and billions, of lucky, appropriate events. Thus, miracles would become the rule. Events with infinitesimal probability could no longer fail to occur. There is no law against daydreaming, but science must not indulge in it. That's opinion of an evolutionist when it comes to that problem. Well, another problem with random mutations and natural selection is, and I always seem to get back to this, the idea of irreducible complexity problem. Again, according to evolution, random mutations working in tandem with natural selection make gradual, almost imperceptible, positive changes over millions of years, and turns one form of life into another. Well, again, irreducible complexity is defined here as a single system which is composed of several interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where the removal of any one of those parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. It means that everything about that system is necessary for its function. You take out one of the cards and the whole house of cards necessarily falls down. Again, we use the mousetrap example. Not one of the components of that simple machine can be missing and the machine still work. So the point is simply this. What good is half of a wing or half of a leg? Not much good at all. It doesn't increase the survival chances. But actually, it's much more complicated and complex than that. The theory of evolution must not only explain wings and legs, but it must be able to explain down to the molecular level the changes that are required in order for the theory to be true, that all of these vastly complex molecular systems within, many of which exhibit this property of irreducible complexity, they couldn't have come along by slow, gradual change. They had to be, all of the components of the system had to be there, functioning, in order for the system to work. Okay, now there's the fossil record problem, and I really enjoy studying this aspect of it, because it's such devastating evidence against evolution. Again, these random mutations, this natural selection process, again, would produce these very small changes over millions of years. So our museums of natural history, I mean, they should have warehouse upon warehouse of the transitional fossil from, for example, reptiles to birds, apes to man, and so forth, if evolution were true. Even Darwin recognized the idea that transitional fossils were very important to his theory. Here's one of the quotes from his book. He said that the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. I would agree if it were true, it would be inconceivably great. But assuredly, if this theory be true, such have lived upon the earth. He goes on to say, why then is not every geological formation and every strata full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against my theory. So right out of the gate, Darwin recognized that this was a major problem. He goes on to say, the abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appear in certain formations has been urged by several paleontologists. And we'll talk more about this sudden appearance. It's been urged by several paleontologist as a fatal objection to the belief in the transmutation of species, or his theory. If numerous species belonging to the same genera of families have really started life at once, the fact would be fatal to the theory of evolution through natural selection. Now remember, he's writing in 1859. The science of paleontology was relatively young at the time, and I'm sure that Darwin thought, well, you know, over the years, as people continue to go out there and search for these fossils, that these transitional forms will be found. Well, 155 years has passed since the publication of Darwin's book, and the fossil record is devoid of these transitional forms. And this is very important, that were not only predicted by evolution, but required by evolution in order for the theory to be true. It was something that Darwin himself recognized as we read through the quotations. I've got a quote here from Dr. Colin Patterson, evolutionist. In fact, he wrote a book, the title of Evolution. He was the senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History. Note what Dr. Patterson said in a perhaps unguarded moment. He says, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book." In other words, when he wrote his book about evolution, he didn't illustrate any transitional fossils for one good reason. There weren't any for him to illustrate. He says, "If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one might make a water argument." So, again, the emperor has no clothes. When you look at the so-called geological column, and we've probably all seen something like this in a science textbook at one point in our academic careers, this geological column, by the way, is somewhat of an artificial construct, because there's not one place on Earth that you can go and find all of these layers in the order that they're given here. And that's a whole other story in and of itself. But this is supposed to show that here in the supposedly oldest layers of rock are found the oldest fossils, and as we move up in these geological layers that are supposedly younger and younger, then we find increasingly complex animals. But one thing should really jump out at us here in this very lowest layer called the Cambrian, or one of the lowest layers called the Cambrian layer, we have this sudden appearance of very complex organisms in the fossil record. When you go below this, you find hardly anything at all. And this has been a big problem for evolutionists through the years. In fact, some of these animals that are found in this layer still exist. They're alive. And even some animals in these other lower layers. For example, I can't remember exactly when it was. It's not been too long ago. Within my lifetime, there's a very primitive fish called a coelacanth. Maybe some of you have heard about that. Well, most of the paleontologists thought that the coelacanth had gone extinct somewhere back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth. But lo and behold, off the coast of Africa and off the coast of Indonesia, fishermen have caught coelacanths. So much for that support of their theory. So, more than 5,000 species are found in this lower layer here in the Cambrian. And again, they call this the Cambrian explosion. And it demonstrates fully formed modern creatures. And evolution has a real difficult time with that, because there should be a whole host of transitional fossils down here in these lower layers that led to the fossils found in the Cambrian layer, but that's just not able to be found. Time magazine, which is not noted for its conservatism or support of God and the Bible, but back in December of 1995, they had an issue devoted in a large part to evolution, and one of the articles was entitled "When Life Exploded." It says, "In a burst of creativity like nothing before or since, nature appears to have sketched out the blueprints for virtually the whole animal kingdom." And as I was talking with Al in the foyer this morning, I said, yep, there's a book that describes that, Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Another one from that same article says, "Since 1987, discoveries of major fossil beds in Greenland, in China, in Siberia, and now in Namibia have shown that the period of biological innovation occurred at virtually the same instant in geological time all around the world. What could have possibly powered such an advance? And again, there's a book that describes that. It's called the Bible. Also, and this really isn't part of my presentation, but think of a mechanism that could possibly explain that geological column and the fact that when you look for fossils around the world, you don't find them in every place. You find these humongous fossil beds with billions and billions of creatures that were buried. How do you go about forming a fossil? Have you ever thought about that? Well, the standard explanation, according to evolution, is that these layers of rock were laid down in millions of years, and these animals died and were entrapped in this rock. Right there is a problem, because what happens when a deer gets killed on the road? Is it embedded in rock? No, it lays there, and it's subject to decay, to animals that'll eat it up, and within a matter of weeks, it's gone. So in order for fossils to have formed, there had to be some sort of catastrophic event that took place. And I'll talk more about that in a minute, but let that one roll around in your mind for a little while. Well, another evolutionist says it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families appear in the record suddenly and are not led up by known, gradual, completely continuous transitional sequences. And again, I would say amen to that, and there is a book that describes how they got that way. It's been interesting to me as I study this subject of evolution in general that these problems with evolution have led evolutionary type scientists to come up with alternate explanations for Darwinism. One of them is called panspermia, and as ridiculous as it might sound, basically states that life on Earth was seeded here from outer space. I think this is a attempt to overcome the fact that spontaneous generation is such a wild idea that people know can't be true. And the people that have supported this are very well-known scientists. For example, Francis Crick was a major proponent of panspermia. He's dead now, but he and Dr. Watson in England were the ones that first came up and were able to determine the structure of DNA. Also, Stephen Hawking, you've seen him, the poor fellow with ALS, who's stuck in a wheelchair, he believes that as well. Now, there's a big problem with that in the sense that, first of all, it's a wild idea. When a meteor come into the atmosphere, doesn't seem too hospitable for life as it burns up and creates a shooting star. I wouldn't think that would be very beneficial. But even if it were possible, all that does is takes spontaneous generation that supposedly occurred here on Earth and puts it somewhere else in the universe, because at some point in time, non-life had to turn into life. So I don't understand how that notion could be of any benefit. Another one, and I think this is in response to the fossil record and the fact that there are not these transitional forms that not only the theory predicts but requires. Scientists have come up, and they're fond of these fancy names, come up with a notion called punctuated equilibrium. And one of the major proponents of that was a professor named Stephen Gould. He's passed away now, actually rather young in life, but he was quite famous and on a lot of public television programs and so forth. But he was a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist at Harvard. And basically what he said with punctuated equilibrium, and it has a nickname, and this nickname is given by people within the evolutionary field, so I'm not being derogatory to him. It's called the hopeful monster theory. And basically what he states is that instead of evolution occurring in these fine gradations through millions of years, that there were these times of punctuated equilibrium when it made these sudden leaps. For example, a lizard laid an egg, and instead of a lizard coming out of the egg, a bird came out. Well, how ridiculous can you get? But it shows what happens when the theory is an emperor without clothes. So summarizing then on this point, instead of the theory of evolution, instead of supporting the theory of evolution, mutations and natural selection actually show that the theory is false. Again, a quotation. To propose and argue that mutations, even tandem with natural selection, are the root cause of 6 million viable, enormously complex species is to mock logic, deny the weight of evidence, and reject the fundamentals of mathematical probability. Again, the words of an evolutionist. Another one with a very similar name stated it this way. He says, I suppose that nobody will deny that it is a great misfortune if an entire branch of science becomes addicted to a false theory. But this is what happened in biology. I believe that one day the Darwinian myth will be ranked the greatest deceit in the history of science. When this happens, many people will pose the question, how did this ever happen? So, random mutations and natural selection are total non-starters, just as spontaneous generation is. They are mechanisms that leading evolutionists recognize cannot legitimately power the theory. So again, it's a fatal blow to the theory of evolution, and indeed, the emperor has no clothes. Now, the next one is that we evaluate either evolution or creation is time. Recall that evolution requires a lot of time, massive amounts of time. Time for these helpful mutations to create very complex organisms. So, does the scientific evidence support an Earth that's over 4 billion years old? Well, first of all, there's a fossil problem. And when you start digging into the fossils or looking at sedimentary rocks, two terms become very important: uniformitarianism and catastrophism. You see, evolutionists are uniformitarianisms. They believe that the current processes on Earth have existed for these billions of years. Things just go on as they go on. And for example, here in the Grand Canyon, that these layers of rock were laid down, took millions of years for each layer. So as they look at that column, you know, they would see millions upon millions of years in order to explain the formation of that. Whereas catastrophism states that things like the Grand Canyon were not formed over millions of years, but they were the result of some great catastrophe that took place. Well, how about that? Is that, which one of those could possibly be true? Well, let's look at some pictures. This canyon, how long would you think that would have taken to produce that? Maybe millions of years? Well, it's actually produced in a matter of hours and days. That's Mount St. Helens. And just shows what even a relatively, geologically speaking at least, small catastrophe can produce. Pictures from Mount St. Helens again, showing carving of this canyon that when you look at it without, and I admit that we're not looking at it on the scale that we would look at the Grand Canyon because it is a much smaller scale, but it looks very close in many respects to what you would see at the Grand Canyon. And again, this was formed in a matter of hours. It's a picture from the same place. Very reminiscent of other canyons. Another picture from the same place. So imagine the power of something like Noah's flood would have produced, where the entire earth was involved. Especially as that, you know, we read in the Bible, the fountains of the deep were broken up. There was all of this breakage of the earth's crust as the flood built up the level of the waters. And then as the waters receded. Now, when I was a young boy, there was a woods that we used to go play in that had a creek, and every spring that creek would flood. It wasn't a big creek, and it wasn't a big flood, but you could see some pretty dramatic changes after the flood had taken place and the water had gone back to normal. One thing you would see would be the digging of these channels, albeit much smaller scale, but you would also see collections of rubble as all of this rubble was mixed into the water, then finally drained to the lower spots in that creek system. And one can imagine the same thing taking place after the flood, that as the flood waters recede, all of this mud, all of these bodies of dead animals and so forth would drain into these places where they're entrapped in the soft rock. That rock builds up, the pressure builds up, and forms the fossils. And what do we see in reality? We see something that is very explainable by that mechanism. We see fossils not evenly distributed throughout the earth, but we find them in these vast fossil deposits. Well, let's look at some more quotations here. One scientist, this happens to be a creationist, he says, vast animal graveyards and fossiliferous rubble shifts have been found worldwide. Evidence of a great, sudden, and recent water cataclysm, followed by a deep freeze across the entire north, accompanied by titanic hydraulic forces and crustal upheavals, burying a host of mammoths, mastodons, elephants, and other great beasts in a region which is now almost totally devoid of vegetation has been documented. It's also interesting to note when you look at the fossil record, you see animals fossilized that were in the very process of eating other animals. So when they were fossilized, it was something that happened very quickly. I've read of them finding mastodons that still had their mouths full of the forages that they were foraging on at the time they were encased or trapped, if you will. Well, this gentleman goes on and says, vast numbers of fossil trees and plants standing erect, oblique, and even inverted, while piercing through successive beds of water laid stone have been discovered. I'll show you some pictures of that later. There is an abundant evidence of profuse vegetation and a temperate, even subtropical climate prevailing in Antarctica and the northern polar regions at some time in the past. Worldwide fossilization has occurred in vast quantities. That's another problem that bothers me. When they find these fossil beds, they don't find just a few fossils, which you would expect if, you know, the uniformitarian view was correct, and, you know, animals have a normal lifespan, they die and would get fossilized and so forth. No, you just find these vast deposits of billions of fossils. Okay, worldwide fossilization has occurred in vast quantities, including fossils in sedimentary strata, often at great depths and under great pressure. Vast and numerous rifts, fissures, and lava beds have been discovered, scarring the ocean floor, all clearly recent, and speak of some gigantic submarine upheaval of the Earth's crust, as in breaking up of the fountains of the deep. Marine fossils have been found buried and exposed at almost every altitude. And on such evidences could be listed. So again, when you look at the fossil record, it screams catastrophe, not uniformitarianism. Well, this is one of my favorites. It's called a polystrate fossil. Poly means many, straight, strata. So what you see here is a log, a tree, that is going, is covered by many different strata. Okay? Now, the uniformitarian view, the evolutionary view, is the strata built up. How long did it take? It took millions of years. Well, obviously, if that's the case, then here at this lower level, this tree got stuck in the mud. Now, what would happen even over a period of years to that tree? It's going to rot and decay. It's going to disappear. So this tree had to be covered up very quickly by all of these strata. And I would suggest that the difference in strata is just the difference in the settling rates of particle size that's entrapped in the floodwaters. It's interesting, and I don't have a picture of it, but you can look, Google it. There are very similar trees in the Mount St. Helens catastrophe. If you've seen pictures of that, when that volcano blew, it just literally mowed down thousands upon thousands of trees. And many of those trees, it literally pulled them up by the root so that there would be this ball of mud and small ball of mud and roots at the bottom of the trees. And some of these trees were washed down into what had been Spirit Lake that was associated with Mount St. Helens. Well, it was a nice, beautiful blue lake turned into a gigantic mud hole. And what they found over time is that these logs laid there in the mud, then gradually, as they absorbed water, they stood up on end. So it looked like they had been in place in that location, but actually they have been transported many hundreds of yards, if not further, by the blast from the volcano. And eventually, that's what they're going to turn into, because they sink down into the mud, covered by the mud, and they'll be petrified in that position. Well, another problem with the time problem, with the geological column here, is the circular reasoning problem. Now, evolutionists are very sensitive about this thing, but it is true. And over many, many years, the circular reasoning came in that geologists who study the rocks would date the rocks by the fossils they contained, whereas the evolutionists would date the fossils by the rocks in which they were found. Well, that's a major case of circular reasoning. They each need to independently come at the date rather than relying on the other group to provide the dates for them. Another problem with this time aspect is the radiometric dating problem. Scientists use radiometric dating methods to date rocks, to date fossils, and so forth. And that radiometric dating is based on the radioactivity of certain elements. Certain elements exist as isotopes. For example, there are three major isotopes of carbon, carbon-12, carbon-13, and carbon-14. And isotopes are atoms of the same element which have the same number of electrons and protons. Electrons spin around the nucleus, protons are in the nucleus, but they differ as to the number of neutrons in the nucleus. And certain isotopes are radioactive, and there's many different forms of radioactivity, but it's either they eject particles from their nucleus, they eject electrons, and there's other associated radiation with them. But over time, what that causes them to do is change from one isotope to another. So scientists have kind of clued in on that and use that as a method of dating things. Now, in radiometric dating, and this is would be used for carbon-14 dating, there's always a parent element. It's the radioactive isotope. And it turns into a daughter element that is non-radioactive. There may some radioactive methodologies. There are many, many steps here as this change takes place from parent element to daughter element. But I just chosen one of the more simpler ones here, that carbon-14 that's radioactive, it emits what's called a beta particle or an electron, and when it does, it turns into a stable element, nitrogen-14. But there's a big problem with radiometric dating. There's way too many assumptions. For example, and I'll put it this way, with the example of an hourglass. Let's say you walked into a room and there's an hourglass there on a table. Could you or would you be able to tell how long that glass had been there? Well, it seems pretty easy, and it probably would be with a traditional hourglass. But when you try to make, when you think about radiometric dating, first of all, you need to know how full was this top when the whole process began. Also, was there any processes that either added parent element or took parent element away from the top here before it had a chance to change into the daughter element? The same is true about the bottom. How much of the daughter element was present when whatever you're talking about was first formed? There, you know, that's going to bias your results. The assumption is that you're empty here, and that's a pretty bold assumption. Also, you would need to know if any daughter element was added or taken away that didn't come from the top here. Then also you would need to know, was the size of that hole or that rate of change from parent to daughter, was it constant through time? There's no guarantee that that was true either. Well, before you accuse me of being unscientific, I've read a lot on this, because I actually, when I was doing my master's degree, took a course in radioactive, the use of radioactive materials in biological research, which was a very interesting course, by the way. But I've always been interested in radiometric dating. And I'm just picking some here to illustrate the problem. You could find thousands of examples to back up what I'm telling you. For example, petrified wood sample using carbon-14 dated it at 45,000 years old. The potassium-argon radiometric dating system dated it at 45 million years old. You would think there would be a little better agreement on that. Another fossilized wood was carbon-14 active. The current methodology is only able to measure carbon-14 in things that are about 75,000 years old or younger. Otherwise, there's so little carbon-14 in the sample that it's considered carbon-14 dead. But anyway, this fossilized wood sample was carbon-14 active, but again, the potassium-argon method said it was 250 million years old. Fresh rock from the Mount St. Helens. That would be the hourglass. You had just turned it over, but the potassium-argon method said it was already 350 million years old when it was new. It was a newborn, if you will. One fellow looked at some Antarctic seals. He looked at, first of all, mummified seals, carbon-14, and found them to be anywhere from 615 to 4,600 years old. And looked at freshly killed ones with the same method and said they were 1,300 years old. So there are a lot of problems here. One scientist looked at living snails. Living snails. They weren't dead snails, living. But the carbon-14 method said they were 27,000 years of age. The group that Ken Ham works with, Answers in Genesis, have this group called the RATE team, and that stands for Radioisotopes in the Age of the Earth. And they've done some very interesting work. One thing that they did was they requested samples of coal from the U.S. Geological Survey. Evidently, those folks keep these reference samples of coal. They requested samples of them. You know, many of them, they're supposed to be 300, 400, 500, 600 million years old. And they sent these samples off to an independent laboratory. And lo and behold, all of the samples were carbon-14 active, when, in fact, hundreds of thousands of, or millions of years ago, all traces of carbon-14 should have disappeared. They even had dinosaur fossils examined. Dinosaurs were supposedly extinct 65 million years ago, but these dinosaur samples showed carbon-14 activity. The one that really got me was they looked at diamonds. Of course, these weren't the diamonds you wear around your finger, but industrial diamonds, the lower quality ones. And they were carbon-14 active as well. So what do we conclude? Well, one scientist put it this way. He said, it's obvious that radiometric techniques may not be the absolute dating methods they are claimed to be. Age estimates on a given geological stratum by different radiometric methods are often quite different, sometimes by hundreds of millions of years. There is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock. The uncertainties inherent in radiometric dating are disturbing to geologists and evolutionists, and I can certainly understand why after looking at the evidence. Another scientist said the radiocarbon method is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. There are gross discrepancies. The chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually selected dates. That is a big problem. In the course of my research, if I would have been cherry-picking data, I can guarantee you what would have happened to me. I would have been without an assistantship and booted out of the university. But unfortunately, that has taken place. This scientist goes on to say, this whole blessed thing is nothing but 13th century alchemy, and it all depends on which funny paper you read. So radiometric dating is unreliable. Well, there's some other time problems, and I'm just going to give you a sample of them. The list could go on and on and on. One concerns the Earth's magnetic field. Most of us understand that the Earth is a huge magnet and has this magnetic field that envelops us for, goes thousands and thousands of miles out into space. And we are fortunate that we are blessed with this magnetic field because it wards off a lot of the harmful radiation that comes from outer space and from the sun. Well, the thing about the magnetic field of the Earth is that it's decaying. It's becoming weaker and weaker. Well, calculations reveal that the Earth's magnetic field cannot be more than about 10,000 years old. And that certainly fits in with creation versus evolution. Another one concerns the salt concentration of the ocean. The salt concentration of the ocean increases every year. As rain falls on the continents, it picks up minerals, travels through the rivers and out to sea. The sun evaporates the sea to a certain degree, so you get a higher concentration of minerals in the ocean. But the oceans are not nearly as salty as you would expect if the Earth was billions of years old. In fact, the calculations I've seen says that the Earth could be no older than about 62 million years given the current concentration of salt in the ocean. Another one is helium concentration in the Earth's atmosphere. It's gradually increasing. This one gets to be quite complex, but as radioactive minerals in rock emit radiation, it forms helium. And you know helium is a very, very light element. And helium actually can leaks out of rocks as this process takes place, and it goes into the atmosphere. The current concentration of helium in the atmosphere is only about 1/2000 of what we'd expect if the Earth was actually 4.5 billion years old. Another one concerns the Earth's human population. Right now, the human population is growing at slightly less than 2%. And if we conservatively drop that growth rate to 0.5% per year to account for more famines, wars, and so forth in the past, the Earth population, if humans had been on the Earth for 100,000 to 200,000 years, would be 10 to the 2100th power. Be so many people, we wouldn't even be able to lay down at night and go to sleep. But at a 0.5% growth rate per year, and I find this really interesting, it would take about 4,000 years to produce the current Earth's population. And it's been about 4,000 years, a few years since the flood. So there are literally dozens of other examples that we could cite that would support creation and a young Earth. Don't have a slide of it, but I got another quote here. There are a number of indicators that seem to indicate an age of no more than 10,000 years at the very most for the solar system and the Earth. The last thing that I want to consider is evidence of design. Again, design demands a designer. And when I look out on the universe, when I look out on the Earth, when I look at myself, all I see is design, design, design. How many of you have ever read the book or saw the movie Contact? Anybody? All right. That was based on a book by Carl Sagan. The movie starred Jodie Foster. It's quite a fantastic movie. I thought it was actually pretty interesting. But anyway, in that movie, Jodie Foster was a scientist for SETI, which means Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And for a period of time, the U.S. government actually funded that group. And they had a big radio telescope, I believe it was down in Puerto Rico, where they would scan the skies looking for radio signals that were evidence of intelligence. And in Carl Sagan's book, they received this message, this sequence of numbers, a total of 261 of these numbers, and it kept repeating itself over and over again. Does anybody know what those numbers are? Prime numbers. Prime numbers are numbers that are divisible only by one and themselves. So they were just ecstatic, these radio signals of prime numbers. Were showing to them that there was some intelligence out there. This was evidence of intelligence. And I would agree, if we suddenly received a message like that, I would find it very intriguing. But the point is, they were excited about this message because it was a designed message. And a designed message implies an intelligent designer behind that message. Let's go back to DNA here. Human DNA, again, encodes and controls everything in the 100 trillion cells in our body and in the cells of every living organism on this planet. It, again, we've talked about this morning. It is the most fantastic information storage and retrieval system that has ever been invented. Now, how could that possibly have occurred by the random collision of molecules? How could you possibly look at a series of prime numbers and say that's evidence of a designer and not say the same thing about the own DNA molecules in your body? Well, I want to just cite a couple of things here from physiology that show evidence of design. When you look at the physiology of vision, there's over 40 complex biological molecules interacting in our eyes that produce vision. Now, over 40 of these molecules interact in a period of picoseconds. That's 10 to the minus 12 seconds. Remember, light travels 186,000 miles an hour. 10 to the 12 minus 12 means the time it takes light to go across a human hair. That's how quick it is. And these 40 molecules, bing, 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 this chain reaction takes place. Then there's 137 some million nerve endings in the back of our eyeball. This chain reaction of these 40 plus molecules ends up creating an electrical impulse that is generated in one or more of these 137 million nerve endings. That travels through the optic nerve to our brains. By the way, it turns the image back right side up so that we can see normally, and we see what we're seeing. And we take that for granted. And it happens millions and millions and millions of times every day. Now, when you study the physiology of vision, not one of those 40 plus molecules can be missing, and the system works. And if that's not evidence of design, then I don't know what is. And not only when you think about those 40 molecules and the eye, the whole reception system in our brain has to be there in order for this system to work. To his credit, this is one thing that Darwin was really worried about. He said this. He said, to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus, he didn't know about those 40 molecules, but he was smart enough to know about other things. But he said, to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest. And I would just say amen to Charles Darwin. Another example is our system of blood clotting, and I would imagine Julie knows a whole lot about this, but it requires over 35 enzymes, cofactors, and cells in order for the process to work. Even if one component is missing, the system doesn't function properly, and the person's at great risk for bleeding and even bleeding to death. Think of hemophilia, but there are a lot of other blood disorders related to this. In fact, there are over 25 genetic disorders due to the mutations that have been identified that negatively affect blood clotting. So again, the emperor has no clothes. The evidence of design is overwhelming. I don't know if you've heard of Charles Dawkins, I think is his name. He wrote The God, what is it? The God Delusion, yeah. He's always fond of saying that, well, it's just the appearance of design. And all I can say is, Dr. Dawkins, give me a break. It's not the appearance of design. It is design. It's all around us. It's screaming at us. So I think the psalmist put it very well in Psalm 139, verse 14, when he says, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. In Psalm 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And again, as Phil read for us, Romans 1, 18 to 20, to believe in evolution, you have to deny the evidence, and the evidence is not only in the Bible, but the evidence is there scientifically. So, the theory of evolution is the classic case of the emperor having no clothes. Scientists at the forefront of inquiry have put the knife to classical Darwinism, meaning the evolutionists themselves. They have not gone public with this news, but have kept it in their technical papers and inner councils. This is from an evolutionist, again, this fellow wrote a book by that very title. He says, the explanation value of the evolutionary hypothesis of common origin is nil. That had to be pretty heartbreaking to him, having written a book on evolution. He says, evolution not only conveys no knowledge, it seems to convey anti-knowledge. How could I work on evolution 10 years and learn nothing from it? Most of you in this room will have to admit that he was at a scientific conference when he said this. Most of you in this room will have to admit that in the last 10 years, we have seen the basis of evolution go from fact to faith. It does seem that the level of knowledge about evolution is remarkably shallow. We know it ought not to be taught in high school, and that's about all we know about it. In another quote from the same person, a growing number of respectable scientists are from the evolution camp. Moreover, for the most part, these experts have abandoned Darwinism, not on the basis of religious faith or biblical persuasions, but on strictly scientific grounds and in some instances, regretfully. So why do they cling to the theory? Again, I'll go back to this quote that we read this morning, again by Dr. George Wald, a Nobel Prize winner. He said, there are only two possible explanations as to how life arose, spontaneous generation arising to evolution, or a supernatural creative act of God. There is no other possibility. Spontaneous generation has scientifically disproved 120 years ago by Louis Pasteur and others, but that just leaves us with only one possibility, that life came as a supernatural act of creation by God. And here's the killer, but I can't accept that philosophy because I do not want to believe in God. Therefore, I choose to believe in that which I know is scientifically impossible, spontaneous generation leading to evolution. And there's only one thing I can say about that. They're guilty of what Paul describes in Romans 1, 18 and verse 20. Well, I hope this lesson has helped you understand that evolution is not only false because it contradicts what the Bible says, and I believe that's very important, but I believe that's another study in and of itself. But the theory is false because it's scientifically untenable, and for a number of good reasons. And even though I've had two rather long sermons here this morning and this evening, there is a wealth of evidence that I didn't even speak about. So we can put our faith completely and totally and trust in what Genesis 1 and 2 says, that indeed, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He created us. He created us in his image. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you need to become one, because the same God that created us one day will call us to judgment. And we'll be judged by the things that we've done in this body. And if we're weighed in the scales and found wanting, then we'll suffer eternal damnation. But if we have our sins forgiven through the blood of Jesus Christ, by obeying the gospel, by living faithful to him, we'll enjoy the glory of heaven forever and ever without end. And I can't imagine how wonderful that's going to be. So if you're here tonight and subject to the invitation, we bid you come while we stand and sing. Don't you want to go to